I think a lot of what we thought was way out in the future suddenly going to be right up front. And that gets very scary because as these tipping points cross over each other and get in the way, some of the effects we do not know about. It is pretty scary. And finally, there is on the Q&A, of course, a question about the other existential threat, and that is nuclear war. The point I would make is there is an inevitability about what's happening with the climate, with the Earth system that humans have generated. Nuclear war is avoidable if humans have common sense. And that's a major difference between the two things.
That's the former Chief of the Defence Force, retired Admiral Chris Barry, speaking on the webinar, Too Hot to Handle: The Scorching Reality of Australia's Climate Security Failure. With Chris Barry on the webinar is the former Chief of the Australian Coal Association, Ian Dunlop, and the Research Director for Safe Climate Australia, David Spratt. And the host for the show was Emily Rice. Yes, welcome to this latest episode of Climate Conversation. I am your host, Robert McLean. This podcast is assembled here in Shepparton, in northern Victoria, Australia, on the lands of the Yorta Yorta people. Yes, the stolen lands of the Yorta Yorta people. I pay my respects to their elders, past, present and emerging. Join me now as we listen to the concluding remarks from Too Hot to Handle, and you'll find a link for the entire recording in the show notes.
Just while I've got you there, Chris, Drew put a question with the mainstream media being pretty complicit with denialism, and how can we change that media narrative with, you know, the alarmist narrative is seized on and ridiculed. Any ideas on how we can change the tone, or what was the response? Who was responding to you last week? I'm assuming it probably wasn't the commercials.
Look, it wasn't. There was no hint that Sky News was interested. There was no interest from the classic Murdoch media. Mm. It was ABC, it was local radio stations and so on. And of course, the Nine organisation. Look, it's tough, this one. And I think trying to spread the word around is difficult because if I looked at the media landscape, I'd say people probably only look at the things that their biases support. And if their bias is they don't want to have any change, they just want the government to pay for more, just handouts, please, et cetera, et cetera, then that's what you get. But my conception of the economy of the future sees dramatic change to the way we structure and do things. And as David pointed out, just looking at the food issues, will Australia have the luxury of being able to support itself food-wise come extraordinary heating in that part of the world, including our northern Australia? What are we going to do with mass migrations and people that want to come and live here because they think it's better than where they're leaving? How are we going to adapt to people who want to be climate refugees? What will the world economy look like? Or is the United Nations broken? Is it incapable of doing the governance that is required to solve this problem?
Emily, if I might jump in, I don't think we should be too pessimistic about the media coverage. I mean, the story last week had really good coverage on the ABC, Guardian, yeah. The Canberra Times, the Sydney Morning Herald, The Age and so on. It was covered in Canberra by the Mandarin and defence reporters and so on. So I think the story gets out there. And my experience of, you know, talking and doing community work and so on is I think that people out there, people in the community get the problem. I think there is great trepidation about what's coming up. They might not articulate it. They may not be able to give you line and verse about climate science, but I think out there, look at the discussions going on about whether people should have children or not. That is driven by climate issues. So I don't think we should underestimate the current capacity of Australian people to have a sense of where we're going. I think they're pretty switched on. There's just a lack of leadership at the top because the fossil fuel industry still hold sway. I mean, we are expanding our gas exports. We are licensing new coal mines while going to the Pacific with weasel words saying, oh, sorry, we'll give you some aid when your countries go underwater. I mean, this is unacceptable, but I think people get it.
Well, I think you're right there. Zoe has written a comment from the audience. She wrote to the minister and got a letter back from public servants saying Labor's policy was to go over 1.5 degrees and use technology, presumably CCS, to draw down emissions later. Zoe says she's disabled and would like to know what ordinary people can do when neither major party has a climate policy in line with 1.5. I guess that's, you know, we are coming to the end of the Q&A, but give us some hope. What can people do, particularly those people listening in tonight, do to agitate for change?
I would say cast your vote the right way around come 2025.
Yeah, and what about you, Neil, from the other side of the world?
Yeah, I think it's exactly the same. I mean, part of the problem is the narrative is frequently either there isn't a problem or we're all doomed, in which case if we're all doomed, there's not much point in doing anything, let's just have a party. The reality is we need to talk about the opportunities as well by acting, whether it be improved air quality because we're not using fossil fuels, better health, whether it be about greater certainty of energy prices because of renewables, or in this context, greater security around the world and therefore better prosperity and well-being. But at the end of the day, it's finding someone to cast a vote for who will actually act on it. Because at the moment, and again, it's not unique to climate change. I'm sitting on a continent where we've got a war raging, not many hundreds of miles away from the United Kingdom, but a lot of people aren't even taking that on board.
Yeah, I think
Ian, yeah.
I think the other issue people can do is to really start thinking about joining the dots, because we are becoming in a media sense extremely parochial. I mean, what people are not seeing is right around the world, wherever you look now, we are seeing extreme events which are way off the radar, whether it be China, the US, Africa, parts of Southeast Asia, as well as here, doesn't get reported very much in this country at all. And the other dimension in terms of, you know, the main thrust, of course, is the argument about national security and the China threat and so on. But the reality is that if we keep on pushing down that path, nobody is going to solve this problem. I mean, the reality is the conflicts around the world are making this problem far worse, just in the hard-nosed sort of emissions aspect of it in itself, apart from the distraction that's taking us away from it. So I think people need to realize that all of the cost of living concerns we have, behind it are big issues like climate, like the fact that we're creating more and more conflict, all of which is adding in to people's personal discomfort in a very short-term sense. And, you know, the policies we've got are not doing anything to get on top of that in any fundamental sense. So those dots are not being joined, and the more discussion we have on it, the better.
Thanks, Ian. And we've probably got time for one more question, and I apologise to everyone out there. The questions are fantastic, well-formed, well-educated, and all very relevant. And unfortunately, as I said before, we are moving very fast tonight. Karen Palmer has a question. As an end of PhD candidate at an Australian university working on climate science, sea level rise, she's interested in Ian's point about fractured strategy in climate science. What are the primary steps forward in improving the translation of science to risk management? And there have been a few questions on this point. Another question was, should we move out of in adjunct to the scientific realm, should we bring in risk management and risk experts to try and get the politicians to listen? I think we'll start with you, Ian, and then please jump on everybody else, and then we'll probably just about have to finish up. So,
well, very quickly, I mean, the core issue I touched on earlier, I mean, the problem is that most of the risk assessment that's going on is structured around the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change reports, which basically downplay the risk. They don't look at the extremes. A lot of very good work has been done by the IPCC, but it has also been sat upon by governments, so that some of the more radical concerns that are around are not talked about. And those include the big risks of tipping points and so on. So company directors, whether they be company directors or governments or whatever, people who are doing risk management must look at the extremes of these issues and start to plan strategies that can handle them, because those are the things that are going to destroy us, and we must stop, we must at all in all events stop occurring. So it's that sort of approach of taking it beyond what is accepted as conventional wisdom to really understand the full extent of the threat we're faced with.
I'll
just jump in very briefly.
Ian and I, and I'm sure
many others have had conversations with some of Australia's leading scientists about the problem. And I think it's a problem of when things get stuck in government, the silos, the biffo between departments and agencies about money and who's going to do what and who's got the money for the model and so on. I mean, what I'm hearing from scientists today, are they saying at the top of this process, we need an independent panel of scientific and risk experts who sit above this and can give some advice and try and coordinate what's going on, because it's stuck in a bureaucratic maze and it's not working. So independent expert overview, supervision and review of how we do climate science and apply it in policy and risk management.
Thank you, David. And Neil, then followed by Chris, I'll get your final thoughts as well, because as I said, we are running over time now on that question or something you want to impart with the audience.
I think very briefly, we know enough to know that we've got to act and we need to act now. Governments will only act when they're under pressure from the electorate. And it's in our hands as the electorate to put that pressure on governments to act in our good, in our benefit and interests.
Thanks, Neil. And Chris?
Well, I think it's a great opportunity to say a couple of simple things. First of all, I started in 2008 and was often told that if we scare the horses, people will get frightened and they won't be interested. Well, I think it's far too late to even think about those kinds of things. We have to level with people and tell them what it's really like. The second point I want to make is I see a huge shift in the science that's come around in the last sort of 5 years plus, as some of the comfortable and complacent estimates of the past have proved to be wrong. It's one of the reasons why I said I think Will Steffen might have been wrong about 2030. The way I see things, and I think David's graphs pointed to this, you look at the lags in the system and the growth in temperature changing, I think a lot of what we thought was way out in the future suddenly going to be right up front. And that gets very scary, because as these tipping points cross over each other and get in the way, some of the effects we do not know about. It is pretty scary. And finally, there is on the Q&A, of course, a question about the other existential threat, and that is nuclear war. The point I would make is there is an inevitability about what's happening with the climate, with the Earth system that humans have generated. Nuclear war is avoidable if humans have common sense. And that's a major difference between the two things. And I think, were we to have an existential threat come real on climate change, it will be ugly, it will take a long time to have its full effect, and frankly, I don't want to be here.
Thank you, Chris, on that note. Unfortunately, it's all we have time.
Now, please don't forget, you'll find a link for that entire event in the show notes. Let's hear now about fossil fuel subsidies in Australia.
$14.5 billion. That's how much fossil fuel subsidies cost Australian governments over the last financial year. That's $27,581 for every minute of every day over the last financial year. Using public money to fuel climate change is a choice. Not one that I'd make, but it is a choice. But that's not even the craziest part. As climate change gets worse, and as the need to reduce emissions gets more urgent, the world needs to use and produce less fossil fuels, not more. So you'd think that the subsidies would be decreasing, but no. Actually, the subsidies are increasing. They've risen by over $3 billion since last year with no signs of slowing down. Australian governments are predicting that fossil fuel subsidies will cost $65 billion over the next 5 years. I'll say that again, $65 billion. That estimate has also increased from last year's $57 billion. To put these numbers into context, the federal government is planning on spending over 5 times more on fossil fuel subsidies than its key housing policy, the Housing Australia Future Fund. The biggest individual subsidy, coming in at a whopping $9.6 billion, is the fuel tax credit scheme. It's a tax break that mainly benefits the mining industry, and about $1 billion of it goes to the coal industry. There's also billions for gas in the NT, $500 million for coal mines in Queensland, and $27 million spent by the Coal Innovation Fund in New South Wales, to name a few. Budgets are about choices. It's a great time to be a fossil fuel company in Australia. Not so much if you're on JobSeeker and trying to find an affordable place to rent. Australia is a wealthy country and we can afford to do anything we want, but not everything we want. It's time to stop funding climate change and instead invest in policies that make Australia a better place to live.
And now you can read about that on a story from the Australia Institute headlined, Fossil Fuel Subsidies Hit $14.5 billion in 2023-2024. Up 31%. And you'll find a link for that story in the show notes. And now we have another 90 seconds from Yale Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. The Adirondacks region of New York is famous for its brook trout fishing. But as the climate warms, this cold water fish is in trouble. Stephen Jane is a postdoctoral fellow at Notre Dame University. He says in the summer, the sun warms the water near a lake's surface. Warm water is less dense than cold water, so it forms a layer that floats on top of the cooler water below.
In many lakes, it stays that way until late in the fall when the air temperatures cool down.
That top layer can get too hot for brook trout, and it's getting even warmer as the climate changes. But the fish may be unable to find refuge in deeper water because there may not be enough oxygen there. A lake's oxygen supply gets depleted by fish and other organisms and replenished with oxygen from the air. But during the period of the year when the layers of the lake do not mix, oxygen cannot reach the deeper waters. As the climate warms, that period is lasting longer, so brook trout are having a harder time finding water that's cool enough and oxygen rich.
They're just getting squeezed into the smaller and smaller available habitat.
So anglers may find fewer brook trout in Adirondack lakes. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To learn more about climate change, visit climateconnections.org.
Fran Kelly, the host of RN Breakfast, Radio National Breakfast on the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, talked yesterday with the Shadow Finance Minister, Jane Hume, about many things, among them nuclear power. Let's have a listen now to what was said on yesterday's RN Breakfast.
And does that go for nuclear too? Because, you know, we know that the Future Made in Australia Act, one of the key sectors, focus sectors for that will be the energy sector, as you've mentioned. The government, the opposition rather's plan for the energy transitions largely seems to be nuclear. Yesterday, Angus Taylor, the shadow treasurer, told insiders that nuclear would need to be capable of delivering a commercial return. But I haven't seen any of the experts suggesting that that is possible, anywhere near possible, in the near term. So would you provide subsidies or government funding to start a nuclear industry in Australia?
Well, again, we will announce our nuclear energy policy not at a time of the media's choosing or at a time of the government's choosing, but a time of the coalition's choosing. But it will be very clear in advance of the next election the way we want to go about opening up a new energy source for Australia that will deliver emissions-free energy and lower energy prices by increasing the mix of types of energy over the long term.
And will you be able to do that without subsidies? I'm sure you've had a good look at this.
That's fundamentally important. But in the short term and in the medium term, of course we need a transition through gas. And that's,
which the government's just announced.
Well, the government has announced a future gas strategy and it's already torn their cabinet apart. That future gas strategy on first blush seems to be a reinstatement of principles. There doesn't seem to be any financial support behind it. I'm hoping that we see something in the budget tomorrow night.
But you don't want financial support for it, do you? You don't want subsidies.
Quite frankly, unless we see an encouragement of new supply into the system, it doesn't need to be subsidies. It can actually be fast-tracking of approvals in places like Beetaloo or Scarborough or Bass Strait or Narrabri. These are places where we need to see more gas supply come into the system to support the transition to a net zero energy future.
And just before we finish with nuclear, earlier this year the Coalition said it would announce its policy before the federal budget, which is tomorrow. When will we see it? Will Peter Dutton release it in the budget reply speech?
Well, it is a very career-limiting move for a shadow finance minister to preempt what is in the leader's budget in reply speech. But what I will say is we will announce our policy on energy, as we will on tax, as we will on other issues, prior to the next election. Okay. And we won't be driven by the government's agenda. This is going to be the Coalition's agenda.
Yes, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. It's been great to have you along. I urge you to follow this podcast because if you do that, you'll be alerted every time I publish a new episode. Beyond that, I urge you to share this podcast. Let your friends know what's happening with the climate crisis. So put it on your networks or send them the link in some way. Also, I'd love to hear from you. I want to have your voice on this podcast. So please contact me at r.mclean7@icloud.com and I can contact you over the phone, via email or via Zoom. So please contact me. Also, I'd love to know what you think about this podcast. So, again, using that email address, contact me. Let me know what you think. Good or bad, don't hold back. I need to know. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind. For everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. So take care and stay safe.